CAD spokesperson, Masar Badil, Movement Vancouver. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief, Basir Press, out of Moscow. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Hamas says the U.S. administration is a full partner in Israel's genocide and massacres in Gaza, are providing cover for the regime's crimes. Human rights organization says the people of Gaza face an increased risk of infections and epidemics due to the collapse of the health system. And U.S. police arrest dozens of pro-Palestine students at Yale University as protests against Israeli genocide in Gaza gain momentum at American campuses. Thanks for joining us. Hamas says Israel does not hesitate to commit the most heinous atrocities against civilians in Gaza, with the U.S. administration providing it criminal cover. In a statement, the Palestinian Resistance Movement said the U.S. is a full partner in the Israeli genocide in the besieged strip. Hamas added that the discovery of mass graves inside Nasser Hospital in the city of Khan Yunis confirms that Palestinians are facing a fascist enemy thirsty for murder and blood. Civil service workers in Gaza have recovered the bodies of nearly 300 Palestinians in several mass graves in Nasser Hospital's courtyard, most of them women, children, and the elderly. Mass graves were created when Israeli forces were besieging the facility last month. Some of those executed were blindfolded and handcuffed. A Geneva-based human rights organization warns that civilians in Gaza are facing an unprecedented health and environmental catastrophe amid Israel's ongoing genocide in the besieged territory. Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor said the risk of infectious diseases and epidemics has greatly increased in Gaza due to water contamination, overcrowding, the scarcity of medicines, and the collapse of the health system. It added that children, especially newborns, the elderly, and people with chronic health problems are the most affected by the worsening health catastrophe in Gaza. Euromed said most of the people in Gaza are forced to drink polluted water, which has caused the spread of diseases like cholera, diarrhea, dysentery, and hepatitis. An independent review says that Israel has yet to provide evidence for its terrorism allegations against UNRWA employees. The report said the UN Relief Agency for Palestinian Refugees had regularly supplied Israel with lists of its employees for vetting. However, it said that Tel Aviv had not informed the agency of any concerns relating to any of its staff since 2011. The review stressed that UNRWA remains irreplaceable and indispensable to Palestinians' human and economic development. The independent review was led by the former French foreign minister, Catherine Colonna. The UN set up an investigation group following Israeli allegations in January that 12 UNRWA staff participated in the anti-Israel operation carried out by Hamas on October 7 of last year. The accusations led major donors to cut their funding to the agency. Israeli forces have shot and killed a Palestinian man in Ariha, a town in the occupied Jordan Valley. The regime has intensified its raids across the West Bank ever since it launched a genocidal war in Gaza. To get more on the latest Israeli raid, we are now joined by our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil. Mona, good morning. What has happened here?
Well, we can say that every day when the Israeli forces are storming Palestinian areas, if we are not speaking about Palestinian martyrs, then we speak about Palestinians had been shot and wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces. This morning, the Palestinian Ministry of Health revealed that a 44-year-old Palestinian, Shadi Jalaita, father of three, from Aqba Jabir refugee camp, was shot and killed by the Israeli forces. Before dawn, Israeli troops stormed the city of Ariha, the refugee camps of Aqba Jabir and As-Sultan in Ariha, in order to conduct arrests among Palestinians. This is what the Israeli military claimed, the aim of the military operation. They claimed that Palestinians had been engaged in a number of anti-Israeli activities, and they were planning to carry out anti-Israeli operations during the military operation to conduct Palestinians. The Israeli forces, as usual, and as what they have been doing in the last few months, using their guns to shoot and kill people. They shot and killed this Palestinian, Shadi Jalaita, and wounded two. This brings the number of the Palestinians who had been killed by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October to over 487, according to the recent data by the issued by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, in addition to the fact that tens of thousands of Palestinians had been wounded. Over 8,400 Palestinians had been arrested by the Israeli forces only since the Israeli regime started its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. This morning and last night, Israeli forces stormed several areas across the occupied West Bank, in addition to Ariha, of course, and the refugee camps. The Israeli forces stormed Jenin, Tul Karim, Qalqiya, several areas around Ramallah, as well as Beit Lahem and Nablus.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and the Israeli military continue to exchange fire along Lebanon's southern border as tensions remain high amid Israel's war on the besieged Gaza Strip. In a fresh development, Israeli forces have targeted a vehicle, killing one of its passengers. For more on that story, we are now joined by Mariam Saleh. Mariam, good morning. What has happened here?
Yes, we do know that there was a vehicle that was targeted in the area of Abu al-Aswad, in the area of Zahrani, and this is the highway mainly that is goes from south Lebanon all the way towards to Beirut. This is a new development in an area which is generally an area where you have a lot of civilians pass by that highway. And so it's not a new development, since the Israelis have, of course, begun with this type of a strategy in targeting specific vehicles, which they say have members of Hezbollah. We are yet to confirm whether the person that was killed today was a member of Hezbollah or not, since before we've had make these claims and we've had civilians die as a result of such attacks. Of course, the Israelis have begun this type of strategy after targeting and assassinating a senior Hamas official, Saleh al-Aruri, and that was a targeting deep in the heart of the southern suburbs of Beirut. The Israelis seem to begin that by then a series of assassinations, and it seemed that after that we did not see a full-scale war. The Israelis are somewhat careful not to target civilians. However, yesterday we did have an attack in one of the towns that is Srifa, And that town is around 14 kilometers away from the closest border point. And in that area specifically, there was a family that was living in that same residential building that was targeted, and miraculously, they survived that attack. And so if those civilians had been killed, that would have been extremely dangerous. Hezbollah, of course, still retaliated because this was considered a direct targeting of civilians. That targeting what led to a rocket, a Katyusha rocket launched by Hezbollah, and maybe 40, maybe 50 Katyusha rockets that were launched against the Hebron Air Base, against the 91st Division, the central headquarters, the Israeli infantry is in the 91st Division, close to Tafat as well. And so Hezbollah made it clear that they will not tolerate attacks and Israeli strikes that come anywhere near civilians. And so we are yet to see, of course, who the martyr is in this attack specifically, to see how they will respond. Hezbollah has, of course, like I said, in addition to the targeting of Katyusha rockets, very significant bases, which the Israelis say, but also a very significant operation. But the Israelis are extremely angry also at the fact that Hezbollah has been taking down their UAVs. Yesterday, Hezbollah took down the fifth UAV, and it's the fourth Hermes UAV, actually. And this was also considered a heavy for the Israelis. And this is why I think the Israelis are attempting to lock their targets against law members if they do have the intelligence that they need for that. But Hezbollah is still definitely basically hitting back in a manner that has also weakened the Israeli defenses on several scales as well. The Israelis also launched several targets in against the towns of Yaqun, for example, in the area of Jabur, which is also far away from the border. That is an area considered also basically a mixed area. You have many Christians and Muslims, and this is, there's a lot of civilians living in that town as well. And so this is considered a dangerous when it comes to how Hezbollah looks at it. Hezbollah has attempted, of course, since the beginning to try to make it as limited as possible in that geographic space. They have succeeded in not bringing the Israelis into launching a full-scale war against Lebanon, but the Israelis are going further and deep into the heart of Lebanon when it comes to targeting, giving a specific target. That is, of course. Now, we're waiting today to see what type of retaliation Hezbollah will take as a result of this attack against this vehicle specifically.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that. Thank you very much. That's Mariam Salah there from Beirut. Thank you. Thousands of Israelis have once again held rallies against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for his failure to secure the release of captives in Gaza. The protesters gathered outside of Netanyahu's house. They said that they want to exert more pressure on the cabinet to strike a deal with Hamas to bring the captives back. They also marked the religious holiday of Passover, which contains a ritual meal. But instead of having the meal, protesters set fire to a table to show their anger at Netanyahu. Israeli officials say 129 captives remain in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of captives have also been killed in the regime's airstrikes on Gaza. Hamas says it wants a complete ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza as part of a ceasefire deal to release the captives. The resistance movement also wants the return of the displaced people to their homes. Pro-Palestinian sentiments reach fever pitch among American university students as protests against the Gaza genocide are now in full swing on campuses.
Time for us to show that yes, we want to be visible. The university should do something about what we're asking about the genocide that's happening in Gaza. They should stop investing in this genocide that our people is now suffering from.
Protests at Columbia University have forced authorities to cancel in-person classes. Elsewhere in the Northeast, dozens of protesters were arrested at Yale University. In Massachusetts, gates to Harvard Yard were closed to public in an attempt to head off protests. Students have also set up tents and held rallies and sit-ins at other U.S. campuses across the country. They demand that universities divest finances from manufacturers that sell weapons to Israel. President Ibrahim Raisi says that Iran and Pakistan have inseparable bonds that and are resolved to bolster the relations at all levels. The Iranian president is in Pakistan for a three-day visit. Nasser Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
In a significant diplomatic milestone, the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi embarked on a three-day official visit to Pakistan, marking the first such visit by any foreign leader following the February 8 elections. Upon his arrival at the Prime Minister's house for a meeting with PM Shahbaz Sharif, the Iranian President was honored with a Guard of Honor by impeccably turned-out contingents of armed forces. The Pakistani Premier Shahbaz Sharif extended a warm welcome to the esteemed guest upon his arrival at the venue of the formal welcome ceremony. During a press conference, the visiting Iranian president emphasized the common ground shared by Islamabad and Tehran on various global issues, such as joint efforts against terrorism and addressing human rights violations in Palestine.
There are several common positions and stances between our two countries. For instance, when it comes to fighting against terrorism, both countries are determined to fight against terrorism, organized crime, narcotics and different forms and manifestations of insecurity that endanger our two countries and the region. Today we decided to increase economic, commercial and cultural relations between Pakistan and Iran, and both Pakistan and Iran have agreed to increase trade volume to $10 billion.
The Pakistani premier said that both Iran and Pakistan are resolute in their commitment to combat terrorism and other forms of insecurity that threaten not only our nations but also the broader region. The Pakistani premier thanked Iran for taking a strong stance against the oppression of Muslims in Gaza.
Security Council ki qarardad.
The resolution of Security Council regarding Palestine is still being flouted today. All Muslim countries should raise their voices unitedly until a complete ceasefire in Gaza.
The visiting Iranian president also met with his Pakistani counterpart Asif Ali Zardari and other top-ranking Pakistani officials. Pakistan and Iran said they will continue to promote their bilateral relations in diverse fields including security, political, economic, trade and culture.
The recent visit by the Iranian president to Pakistan underscores the close and fraternal ties between the two nations. Analysts say that this visit will serve to strengthen bilateral relations and foster greater people-to-people contacts between Islamabad and Tehran. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
When Iran retaliated against the Israeli regime in Operation True Promise, it did not anticipate it to be so successful, even by the IRGC's own admission. But the positive reaction worldwide, especially from regional countries, increased Iran's popularity immensely, as explained next.
After Operation True Promise, combined with Iran's unwavering support for Palestine, Iran's perception in the public domain, especially in the West Asia region, has strengthened. Finally, someone had not only stood up to Israel, but had publicly humiliated it and inflicted physical damage to it. Tehran's Operation True Promise, its retaliatory response to the Israeli regime's recent attack on the Iranian consulate building in Damascus, created new rules in the equation of deterrence and strengthened the resistance axis of trust and levels of Iran's popularity among public opinion of the Arab world. Iran's popularity among the broad sections of the public opinion of the Arab world has increased because the people of Arab countries were angry with their government's inaction. When it came to the issue of Palestine and the Israeli regime, they were desperate for the Israeli regime to be confronted. Well, Iran's response was bold in the shadow of the world's silence regarding Gaza and the genocide taking place. The whole world had watched the Zionist regime murder Palestinians for 200 days. Finally, one country had the guts to inflict damage to the Israeli regime, Iran, and Operation True Promise. Iran had gained new political and security credibility with direct retaliatory attack on Israel. No country had dared to attack Israel in the last 50 years. Now, from now on, not only countries in the region, but countries outside of the region will have new calculations about Iran. Iran's reach in worldwide popularity amongst the Muslim countries had also been elevated due to operation. The people of the region praise Iran for confronting Israel's aggression and have criticized their rulers and governments for supporting Israel, especially ones who have normalized relations with Israel. But it wasn't just Arab countries and their population that had praise for Iran. There was mass support when it came to pro-Palestine activists. They praised Iran for launching drones and missiles at Israel. After all, they had been protesting in solidarity with Palestinians and against Israel for months. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during a meeting with the IRGC commander, said, "Iran's powerful presence in the international arena is more important than the number of missiles and drones that were fired on the Zionist regime." He added that the armed forces' recent achievements have created a sense of splendor and magnificence about Islamic Iran in the eyes of the world.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime is abusing UNRWA employees detained in Gaza in order to extract forced confessions against the agency, with detainees describing being subjected to acts of torture. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, UNRWA staff observed signs of trauma and ill treatment, including dog bite wounds, among the released detainees upon their arrival to Karam Abu Salem checkpoint on the Gaza-Israel boundary. Many were transferred to hospitals in Gaza due to injury or illness. Released detainees said they were forced to sit on their knees for hours on end while blindfolded and their hands tied. They described ill treatment, including physical beatings, threats of physical harm, insults, and humiliation, such as being made to act like animals or getting urinated on, use of loud music and noise. Detainees were also deprived of food, water, sleep, and toilets, and prevented from praying. Tightly locked handcuffs caused open wounds and friction injuries, according to UNRWA. While detainees had their ribs broken and shoulders dislocated as a result of beating with metal bars, rifle butts, and boots. Men and boys who were sheltering at an UNRWA installation were forced to strip naked and remained naked during their detention. Men and women were subjected to sexual violence and harassment, threats of rape, and were forced to strip in front of the Israeli troops and photographed and filmed while naked. A 41-year-old man who was detained told UNRWA that detainees were subjected to electrical shocks through their body parts, causing another man he was detained to get sick and die. A woman who was detained said that an Israeli intelligence officer displayed her neighborhood on a computer screen and asked them about individuals residing there. The woman told UNRWA, she said, "If you don't confess with all the information, we will bomb your home and kill your family." The Palestinian Prisoners Club says that the Zionist regime refuses to disclose information on the number of people from Gaza it has detained over the past 6 months or on where they are being held, Reuters reported. Al-Mizan, a Palestinian human rights group based in Gaza, says that Israeli regime forces have detained at least 3,000 people in the territory who are subjected to multiple forms of cruelty, torture, inhuman and degrading treatment from the moment they are arrested. Their detention and interrogation occurs without any judicial oversight or legal protection, in blatant defiance of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, the rights group adds. Around 1,650 Palestinians from Gaza are being imprisoned by the Zionist regime under its unlawful combatants law in total isolation and denied the right to a lawyer or legal representation. Detainees held under this law are neither granted the status of prisoners of war under the Third Geneva Convention nor afforded the protections of civilian detainees under the Fourth Geneva Convention, according to Al-Mizan. A lawyer with the rights group recently visited Ascalon and Ofer prisons, where some 300 Palestinians from Gaza not held under the unlawful combatants law are being abducted, pending investigation. Al-Mizan's lawyer met with approximately 40 detainees who provided harrowing accounts of torture and inhumane treatment, including sleep deprivation and starvation as a form of torture and collective punishment. A 19-year-old told the rights group that three of his fingernails were removed during interrogation, that a dog was unleashed on him, and he was placed in a stress position for prolonged periods during 3 days of interrogation. Al-Mizan's lawyer reported that all detainees suffer from acute emaciation, fatigue, and back curvature due to being forced to bend their backs and heads while walking. The rights group said, "Many were unable to recall the names of people present in the room due to the physical and psychological abuse." According to Al-Mizan's lawyer, in his more than 20 years of working with detainees, he had never encountered conditions as appalling as those observed at Ofer prison. The rights group said that the serious harm caused to Palestinians from Gaza in Israeli detention situates it within the legal framework of the crime of genocide. Al-Mizan added that the Zionist regime's use of systematic and widespread torture constitute crimes against humanity and called on the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrants.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Ever since October the 7th, Muslims have been united in their support for Palestine and the people of Gaza. This unity has manifested itself in protests and other civil actions to oppose the genocidal Zionist entity. Sharia Quds resistance spokesman Abu Hamza recently gave thanks to the resistance actors for their efforts in helping the people of Palestine. But sadly, some within the Sunni world took issue with that, exposing sectarian tendencies and in some cases even siding with the Zionists against what they see as a Shia-led movement. On this week's episode, we will explore questions around unity and what the populations and nations of the Islamic world have done to stand for Palestine and how Muslims should be tamping down sectarian tensions at such a crucial time instead of exacerbating them. But first, let's take a look at how leaders of the Palestinian resistance themselves have cherished the sacrifices of the Islamic Republic of Iran over the years, as well as those of its allies in the region.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Palestinian people has been strong ever since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. But in the last two decades or so, the ties have only intensified on a political, financial, and military level. And this is a fact not lost on Palestinian resistance leaders who have repeatedly gone out of their way to praise the principled stance taken by the Islamic Republic. Back in 2014, when the Gazan resistance was fighting the Zionist occupation, Abu Obaidah, the spokesman of Al-Qassim Brigades, thanked Iran in no uncertain terms for their support for the resistance. A few years later, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, also praised Iran and slammed neighboring Arab countries for abandoning the Palestinian cause. And since the 7th of October, the leaders of the resistance groups on the ground have also been active in praising the resistance axis, with the most recent speech by Abu Hamza of Sharia Quds catching many people's attention, which merely highlights and reaffirms the ties between Palestine and the rest of the resistance axis across West Asia, and most crucially, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
To discuss this important topic are two very special guests. Joining us is Sayyida Emin Mousavi, an up-and-coming political analyst and writer with a master's degree in international conflict studies from King's College London. We also have Latifa Abu Shakra, who is the granddaughter of survivors of the Palestinian Nakba. Thank you so much to you both for joining us. Sister Latifa, let me just begin with yourself. We've heard that clip there, going back many years, decades even, into the relationship between the Palestinians and their resistance movements and those of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance axis. How is public opinion today in Palestine when it comes to Islamic unity? Is there a stress on prioritizing Islamic unity over theological differences? And do you think the recent genocide in Gaza has led to an increase in that focus on unity?
So one of the things that we definitely need to understand is prior to this genocide, you know, we had incredible leaders within the Palestinian resistance, like Nizar Banat, Shahid Nizar Banat, Allah irhamu, who was, you know, in 2021 was actually talking about the fact that these sectarian differences don't serve us, and actually the Shia are the one who have constantly been providing the resistance in Palestine with the resources that they need to keep up the battle. And this was in 2021. This was prior to you know, what we're seeing now in the past 6 months. But now, if you're asking me also what's happening now since the genocide occurred, it was only a few days ago when Iran launched their masterstroke attack that we saw Gazans on the ground shouting out Ya Hussein and Ya Ali and Labayka Ya Khamenei. And these are definite signs of changes in theological differences, in theological unity now within the people in Palestine. But it doesn't mean that the political unity doesn't also exist. So to answer your question, yes, there has definitely been a shift prior to the genocide in Gaza, but more so now, absolutely. We see the people within Gaza changing their entire mindset. They are rethinking their theology even, because they are seeing that the people who stand with them have unfortunately only been the Shia in practice.
And it's interesting because I've seen videos earlier on during the genocide where you had people in Palestine saying, we were lied to. We were told the Houthis were bad, Ansar Allah were bad. We were told Hezb al-Sha'bi were a sectarian militia. We were told that Hezbollah were called Hezb al-Shaytan, and all of these types of terms, mainly because of, you know, differences and tensions around the Syria conflict, but elsewhere. And then they said, now we've seen, yes, in our time of need, who it is who's actually stood with the Palestinian people and who's just abandoned us to our fate, so to speak. So there is that shift. Sister Emin, some parties are, as we can see, trying to revive this question of sectarianism, maybe to draw Muslims away from supporting the axis of resistance and the philosophy of resistance. And in light of Iran's operation over the recent period, we see that that's maybe intensifying as well. Is this maybe to cover up for the shortcomings of those people, as we heard Palestinians saying, we've been abandoned? And maybe there's a bit of guilt there, so they're trying to distract people from that. And also, do you think this sectarianism is organic, or are there other vested interests trying to astroturf this type of sentiment amongst Muslims?
So, definitely. I think we first need to establish that sectarianism is a tool of the West. It was created to fragment us, to divide us, to weaken the ummah. It's not something that's inherent in the Muslim ummah. It's something that is planted. You can kind of think of it as a colonial seed, if you will. And how does this colonial seed benefit the imperial powers of today? Well, it keeps us from upholding a united resistance, which is the occupation's biggest threat. And we know this because, like Latifa mentioned, some of the most valuable people were targeted and martyred by the occupation, killed in cold blood, like Saleh al-Aruri, like Nizar Banat, these people who said that we cannot afford to fragment the movement. We cannot afford to isolate Palestine, the resistance in Palestine, from the wider anti-imperial shifts in the region. We must unite, and we must see that logistically, militarily, financially, the benefit in uniting. And when Muslims buy into this sectarian narrative that's designed to handicap us, it's also important to mention that it affects the quality of your analysis of the situation. So recently we had the Iranian attack, and there was a lot of comments on this all being a display of theatrics. Iran wasn't actually motivated by a need to help or a need to respond, but just to create some chaos, just to instill itself for the sake of it. And that's despite the fact that the Islamic Republic has committed itself to the support of the Palestinian movement, the Palestinian liberation and resistance since its inception. It's provided military, logistic, financial support to it. And
I find it interesting, cut you off, because some people said, oh, they were only responding because their embassy got hit.
Yeah.
But the counter to that is, well, their consulate got hit because they have generals in that consulate.
Exactly.
And those generals are there helping the Palestinian resistance and the resistance axis. They wouldn't have been there in the first place if it wasn't because of the cause of Palestine. Mm. So I think people need to draw out from that very narrow way of analysing it, have a more holistic thing. And the question of sectarianism, I want to quickly put it to you as well, is, of course, there is a lot of maybe anti-Shia sectarianism, but even within the Shia community, there is an attempt to maybe make people apathetic to the question of Palestine and say, oh, it's not our cause, it's a Sunni cause, it's got nothing to do with Shia Muslims. What's it got to do with us anyway? Like, we're not involved. And in a way, that can sometimes be, while it's a very, very small minority view, it can still be a very dangerous attempt to try to draw support away from the resistance axis. Do you have any kind of view on that side of things as well?
Yeah, so I think that really comes down to it, that the fact that sectarianism is planted. It's not inherent in our faith. It's not inherent for Shias. It's not inherent for Sunnis. It's planted. It's an imperial invention. And when you understand that, these narratives simply just dissipate. They don't have any relevance to the conversation. Mm. And like I was saying, even Iran itself, it has been an open obstacle to the imperial interests in the region, more so than a lot of countries like Turkey, like Egypt, like Jordan. You know, it's presented itself not as a Shia nation trying to instill Shia Islam, but as a nation that is committed to liberation, committed to an anti-imperial trajectory for the region. And as Muslims, we need to make sure that we're not dragged into the sectarian narrative, to the sectarian square, because that's exactly what the enemies want us to do. That's exactly what the occupation entity wants. And we've even seen this recently, the
Security Council.
Yeah, so we also saw it with, I forgot his name. His name slips my mind. I think it was Erdogan, the Israeli representative to the UN, where he basically peddled the same sectarian narrative. He said that Iran is simply, it doesn't
attacking
care about Islam.
Aqsa and the, we're defending
yeah,
it.
We're from, defending yeah, it. He also said things like, Iran is just concerned with spreading Shiism in the region.
Yeah.
You know, so we really need to ask ourselves, what is this ideology serving?
Yeah.
Who is it serving?
And we've seen it before as well from the Arabic service of the Israelis as well, literally pushing this kind of sectarian narrative that in many ways doesn't differ from the Takfiri narrative as well. But now we can take maybe a closer look at the strategic vision of Operation Truthful Promise, whereby Iran responded directly against Israeli territory for the heinous terrorist attack that the Zionist entity committed against the Iranian consulate in Damascus.
On the 1st of April, the Israeli occupation entity bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus in a clear violation of international law. The entire world waited and anticipated a response from Iran, and after 10 days, gave the Israeli occupation an ultimatum: stop the aggression in Gaza, and the response will not be as harsh. On the 13th of April, Iran sends the Israeli occupation entity another warning by seizing their ship, in doing so demonstrating their strength. A day later, Iran announced the launch of over 300 missiles and bone-shattering drones into Israel. Some have claimed that the Iranian response was performative, but the message of deterrence that Iran sent was loud and clear and achieved several objectives. This was the longest-range attack in history, an incredible feat for a country under brutal sanctions for the past 40 years. The Israeli occupation entity's economy took a catastrophic hit. According to their sources, their failed air defense systems cost them $1.35 billion, exhausting over 60% of the Zionist entity's military monthly budget, not accounting for the cost for their allies, Jordan, UK, and France. Iran managed to break the prestige of the Israeli occupation entity and expose its fragility, a strategic defeat and a humiliating failure, as it was unable to protect itself by itself. The settler population, upon which the entity relies to legitimize its occupation, fled for their lives, knowing for certain their genocidal government cannot protect them, instead arming them to attack Palestinians in and around their illegal settlements. After such a humiliating blow, the Knesset declared that they would respond. However, their sponsor, the U.S., made it clear that they will not support an attack on Iran, as it cannot sustain an all-out war. The Israeli occupation entity has now opened five fronts on itself. One, the Lebanese front. Two, the Yemeni front, where the Yemenis already hold the occupation entity's economy in a chokehold. 3. The Iraqi front. 4. The Syrian front. And now they've opened the fifth front, which is with Iran. It is likely for the front with Iran, the resistance axis has one goal in mind. Their warning is very clear. Stop the assault on Gaza, and the attacks on the Israeli occupation entity will also be halted. The undertone of their actions has always been, the Palestinians must liberate Palestine.
Now, if I could go to the Operation Truthful Promise, and I'll begin with yourself, Sister Emin, in terms of your thoughts. What were your thoughts in the wake of Iran's retaliation for that unprecedented and illegal attack on their consulate building in Damascus?
The Iranian attack was masterful on many different levels. It was strategically successful. For example, the first point is that we've moved now. This is an indication that we've moved from an era of Israeli attacks against Iranian generals, Iranian sovereignty without a harsh response. That era is over, and that's because Iran has established a new deterrence equation, which is that any form of aggression from the entity will be met with equal, if not more, force to quell it. And that kind of, you know, indicates this shift from strategic patience to deterrence. And, you know, Iran is also now a direct front. It's a direct supporting front, like that of Yemen, like that of Lebanon. It's still slightly different because it is the leader of the Axis, so it functions on a slightly different level. But the significance of that is that Iran will not hesitate to attack, whether that be Israeli ships, whether that be bases, even in the heart of the occupation entity. And the brilliance of this strategy was that it attacked while also navigating a minefield of considerations. It had to make sure that it didn't move attention away from Gaza, that it didn't limit in any way its ability or harm its ability to provide military logistical support to the wider resistance. It also, the biggest thing it needed to consider was that it didn't want to bring in the U.S. into this war, which is exactly what Israel wanted when it attacked the consulate in Syria. It wanted to save face through hiding behind the U.S. So if Iran had failed on any one of these fronts, it would have essentially handed the occupation entity the upper hand. And it succeeded in not doing that.
Yeah.
I think it was also a demonstration of capabilities as well. It was also an opportunity to amass intelligence for any future escalations. Now Iran knows which states will go and run to support the aggressor. How many of them will? When will they? What kind of deterrence methods will they try and use? How, when, and what locations will they use it from?
According to a lot of reports, Iran didn't use its most modern weapons. It used a lot of the oldest new drones that it's got, and not the newer ones. It used older missiles and so on. So a warning there as well, that maybe if you do push the wrong buttons, we will bring out our new technology, which you clearly won't have defenses for, because the older ones did manage to get through. Sister Latifa, what are your thoughts on that operation from last week?
I couldn't have said it better. I think there is something that we do need to talk about in terms of the change of the strategic calculus of the region with Iran, that has now taken a more aggressive and assertive posture within the region. And that is that it went, as Emin was saying, from a strategic patience perspective, where it was allowing its generals to be killed, or allowing maybe isn't the right word, but it was
tolerating
absorbing the aggressions, absorbing the hits, a little bit like Black Panther's suit, and now you know, unleashing all that force. And it needed to do that, as Emin was saying, because there was a lot that needed to be learnt before they could attack Israel. We need to remember that 6 months ago, it's hard to think now, but Israel 6 months ago was this untouchable, you know, incredible entity in the region, you know, a giant that that nobody dared to even speak against, let alone act against. For it now to be this shriveling entity, rightly so, in its place, is all down to Iran and its change of posturing, which has now gone into the deterrence mode, willing to attack, showing that they are truly the maddest in the room, willing to sacrifice. Martyrs are ready at at the borders to go. The people of Iran are waiting for a fatwa from their maraja so that they can go and fight. And if this is the everyday man and woman of Iran, you can imagine the people who have been trained for years watching the massacre of the people of Gaza and the people in Palestine, the humiliation that they have had to suffer for the past 76 years. You know, these are things that are being taught to the people of Iran since childhood. So their love and their passion for the Palestinians exceeds the love of their own nation even. And this deterrence posturing is not a front. They have the weapons, they have the allies, they have built on it for decades, and well, we've seen that it has had an impact on the region, and it will continue to do so.
And it's interesting because that deterrence, as you mentioned, has been there since before, you know, October the 7th. It was to the point where most of the countries of the region were on the brink, well, I say most, but some of the most important ones, like Saudi, there were reports of normalization with Israel. And all of a sudden now we're in a situation where that's likely off the table. And in fact, countries like Saudi and others, despite their close military ties with the Western nations, are distancing themselves and saying, well, we didn't have anything to do with it. It was only Jordan, from all the countries in the region, which went out of its way to support the entity. Sister Emin, if we could come to you finally, just briefly, I want to talk about some of those countries. You've got countries like Turkey, which, you know, Erdogan speaks about the Palestinians and supports them, and yet hasn't cut ties with Israel, continues to trade with them, send them food and gas and other utilities and items, I believe. And of course, Jordan, as we just mentioned, going even further and shooting down munitions, injuring some of their own people in the process. What are your thoughts on that? Why have they done this? Why are they not still, even after this genocide, cutting their ties with Israel?
Well, to put it very simply, they're allies of the occupation entity. They're allies of the US. They are in the camp of the aggressors. They are normalizers. So, for example, you mentioned Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO. Turkey is a US ally. Turkey is one of the biggest exporters to Israel. And Jordan, when Ansar Allah was, you know, seizing these Israeli ships in the Red Sea, it was actually through Jordan and Saudi and the UAE that these routes were being rerouted through. So, and also with Jordan, we can't forget the Iranian attack. It positioned itself with the aggressors. It helped in downing the missiles that the Iranians were kind of inflicting on the occupation entity. And I think even prior to this war, they house the imperial powers in the region. They give a leg for it to stand on. Look at Western bases. Where are they all surrounding? They're surrounding Turkey, the Gulf states. And so really, we understand that all this these pro-Palestinian words, they're just talk. It's just talk, and it's designed to appease the people, because at least these nations are a little smart enough to know that the people side with Palestine. That is the popular sentiment. And it's safe to say that these normalizing entities did not think that this war would go on for so long. They did not think that we would have so much time to see the hypocrisy in their stance and the difference between their words and their actions.
Absolutely. And thank you, Sister Sayyida Emin, for your wonderful analysis and contributions, and yourself as well, Sister Latifa. Always interesting as well to get it from the perspective of a Palestinian on such a key issue at a key moment. And we'd also like to thank you at home. Sadly, that is all we have time for today, but you can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musa. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And in this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. For today, we want to talk about an important topic, and that is the difference, or it's better to say the comparison, as it is between the Western democracy and the Islamic one, as the term that is coined as Mardum Salariye Dini. You know, when we talk about democracy in the Western world, the first thing that comes to our mind is a secular political system. Mm-hmm. But when we are talking about Islam, this human dignity, you know, has come to the scene. But the case is that now where is the place of rationality in the, we can't say Islamic system or the system of values? So when we, from one side, if you are going to pay attention to obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with his own system of values, but from the other side, you have these human beings in the 21st century with his system of value and rationality at the top. So what are we going to do with the concept of rationality over here?
Yeah. So I think it's pure rationality that we see in the philosophy that Islam has actually defined for itself. Look, Islam says the values are absolute, not relative.
Okay.
It means that if something is bad, so it is bad forever. Mm-hmm. And if it is good, it is good, and it has to be praised and respected. But in the other schools, as I said earlier, they just look at a social aspect of it. They say, for example, this might be bad in a society, committing such an action might be bad in a society, but as for me, as a person, I practice it. It's because I'm free. Mm-hmm. So you see, this is the difference. When you have no limitation for you, but we have these limitations,